Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
I'm Alex Cheetle, I'm the founder and chief exec of Ten Lifestyle Group. Before we get stuck into a little bit about the business, really what I want to start off with is just an insight into why we set the business up and what we're trying to do. We set the business up to become the most trusted service business in the world. We believed many years ago, when we first set the business up, that people needed and wanted a trusted service business, particularly in a world where technology was allowing people to sell all of us more and more and more stuff that was good for the person selling it, but not necessarily good for us. So the thinking before we set up Ten was, what would the most trusted service business in the world look like? And clearly it would look like a business that was led by the member rather than the suppliers that were trying to sell stuff to the individual. It would need to be a business that was really high quality and consistently high quality so that people could trust its competence as well as its ethic. And crucially, given that businesses follow the logic of their revenue streams, it would need to align its revenue streams with being the most trusted service business in the world. So we believed it would need to be a subscription-led business. Otherwise, you're going to end up doing what's right for the suppliers or however else you make your money. We also believe that trust comes from regular and often interaction. So we would want to be doing lots of things for our members in multi-categories. If all I do is organize weddings, I can't become the most trusted service business in your life. But we ended up doing travel, tickets, dining, helping people buy things. That gives us enough contact to become very, very trusted in their lives. And personalized is crucial. If I'm asking you to trust me, then I need to connect with you as an individual. What makes that happen better and better and better in our business is technology, and within that, data. You want it to be multi-channel. You don't only want to offer that people can deal with you only digitally or only by telephone or only by email. You really want to say, contact us however you like. And that makes the business more scalable, but it also helps cement you in with the individual who you're developing a relationship of trust with. And of course, the business has to be tech-driven so that you are really using technology to deliver great service and in the ways that the member wants it. One of the final things is you want your business to start dealing with the affluent or the wealthy. And this became clear to us actually shortly after we set up. When we went, for instance, to the top restaurants in London in the early days of Ten and said, great news, we can fill your tables, they said, well, we have no problem filling our tables. Who are you going to fill the tables with? And that was really important. When we go to the airlines and say, great news, we can sell loads of seats on your planes, they're not that interested in that until you say, and by the way, a lot of them are premium cabin, business class or first class, then they're interested. So we realized quite early on that having a focus on people that were affluent or wealthier was going to allow us to give people better service than they could get, than we could get for other people. And that would allow us to become the most trusted service. Scale, obviously, super important because by getting bigger, we get better in multiple ways. I'll come onto that in a moment. So all of that was the thinking behind giving us the confidence when we first set up Ten that if we got the execution right, we could become the most trusted service business in the world over time. And I'd say we are quite a few steps down that road, although we've got a huge amount of work still to do to become the most trusted service business in the world. Bit of an overview. We today organize travel, dining, tickets for music, theatre and sport, and a lot of retail, helping people buy other services and products. We get paid, remember the importance of the subscription model, we get paid in quite a clever way, because the problem with a subscription business is getting individuals to sign up costs a lot in terms of time, effort and cash. And we, quite early on in the business of Ten, in the history of Ten, discovered that we didn't need to be a B2C business. In fact, we could be a B2B2C business, and we could get banks and luxury brands and other brands to pay us to look after their top customers. So where a normal B2C business has to pay a lot to get wealthy people to even know that they exist, let alone to use them. We actually get paid by people like Coutts, as of last week, HSBC to their Jade customers. We might have a few in the room. And people like that around the world. If you buy a Maserati in Japan, you get our service, for instance. That's how we make the majority of our money, is by those brands paying us to look after their top customers. So, you know, HSBC Jade is a good example. We launched with them in 6 markets last week around the world. That's into the early hundreds of thousands of new clients. Zero, well, not quite zero acquisition cost, almost zero compared with the cost of acquiring those individual by individual. And HSBC pay us, so that means we don't need to make money from suppliers. Technology runs through our business. So we use our 10 platform, which is what our members use to book flights, hotels, car hire, restaurants, tickets, to tell us their preferences so we can personalize our service to them better. 10 Made is what our lifestyle managers use. That helps them be more efficient and higher quality and allows us to measure our business. 10 Content is all the content that sits on both of those platforms and elsewhere in our business as well. A brief moment though, to come back to one of the things that make us very successful is this focus on having lots of affluent and well-off members. Now, how that then plays out is we are the most attractive source of business for the world's top restaurants. So if you know anybody in the world of London dining, for instance, ask them about 10, and they'll tell you that we are their most preferred source of business. Why? Our average member spends 80% more than the average person in that restaurant, and we've got a very low no-show rate. And we've spent years getting to know them all, and that's increasingly true around the world. So that's why those restaurants then give us availability and value-add benefits, and they hold tables for our members. So this Friday in London, we would have tables held at kind of good restaurants like Hawksmoor and restaurants like that, through to the really tough ones like a Zuma or a Chilton Firehouse or a Sexy Fish. Sexy Fish last Valentine's Day, a third of the tables in Sexy Fish were our members, held for our members by us in alliance with them. Hotels. Clearly, our members are useful for hotels because they're more likely to spend more money while they're there. They're the right demographic. The airlines like us because it's premium cabin. Box offices is really interesting. We're the only business in the world that buys £80 Adele tickets at scale and sells them on for £80 to people who don't then sell them on. Now, that is life-changing for our members that love going out and watching music, theatre and sport, because we can get face value tickets when nobody else can. Because, and this has really confused the music industry in particular. Music's bigger for us than either sport or theatre. Because when we go out to them and say, we'd like to have 2,000 Coldplay tickets or, you know, 3,000 Ed Sheeran tickets or whatever else, to begin with, the industry was saying, well, what's the catch here? We know that most people want to buy an £80 ticket for £70 so that they can make £10 a ticket. The people that are happy to spend £80, we know what they're really doing. They're selling them on through StubHub or Viagogo for £200. But we can prove that our tickets don't get sold on and that we sell them for £80 because we don't need to make a margin because we've got that subscription income. The feedback that Coutts, HSBC, NatWest Black, Investec Voyage customers in the UK, Merrill Lynch clients, Itaú clients in Brazil, China Merchants Bank clients in China, etc. The feedback they give when we get them into shows that they know are sold out at face value is more than makes the banks happy to pay us to look after the members. Retail is also good too. So what happens there, I mean, sometimes it's as straightforward as a discount. To a closed user group of our members, very attractive because it's not visible to the public. Sometimes it's something like we'd like a fashion house to put on champagne canapes and show us the season and in their flagship store, and they'll do that for us because a few of our members, of the 40 that might be there, might buy a handbag, and just that one purchase of a handbag will pay for that evening another 3 like it. So whether that's a fashion house or a watch brand or whatever else, it means we can do quite a lot in luxury retail as well. All because of that magic mix of a subscription-led business plus the volume of high net worth that we've got. These are some of our corporate clients around the world. Some of the bigger ones for us here in the UK, Coutts, now HSBC Jade. Investec Voyage is relatively small for us, but we like them. They're pretty innovative and good to deal with. Visa, they've launched us into Latin America. We work with them a little bit in the States, lots more that we could be doing there. We don't yet work with them in Europe or Asia very much. We work with flagship banks in Itaú in Brazil, China Merchants Bank in China, and so on. We've got a good business in Japan and so on. And we are actually around the world already. So we're not a business that is about to find out about lots of markets. We're actually in most of the world's top markets. Actually, ironically, the two markets I'd most like to be in that we're not in are Germany and France, very much in that order. Just on our doorstep. In some ways, we've done the tough stuff first. So we've got all the offices we need in the Americas. We've got a lot of the offices we need in Asia. But there's plenty of room to grow in continental Europe, as well as in our existing offices elsewhere. And it's quite expensive setting up these 24/7 language capabilities, but we've done that. One thing which I'll come back to later on, but it's worth bearing in mind, is that our business in our mature markets in EMEA has got an EBITDA margin in the mid-20s. So it's a respectable margin. We can grow that more, but it's a respectable margin. We are investing in growth in Asia, and we're investing in growth in the Americas right now. And the reason for that growth is that when we set up in a new market for the first time, we start off with new lifestyle managers managed by new team leaders, where we don't yet have the local supplier base that we need to put in place. That then takes us quite a lot of time to put in place. It takes us up to 18 months. The first 3 to 6 months are the most difficult. And so we have to over-resource that to make sure that we get the good local relationships with restaurants, ticket companies, theatre producers, whoever else it might be. And that's a big investment for us in the content, the knowledge, and the skill sets of our teams. Once you've got 30, 40 lifestyle managers covering a region with the content and the technologies that they then need to do that, growing that from 30 or 40 to 100 is profitable, good growth. But the very first setup is hard. And that's what we've been doing a lot over here in recent years and this year as well, and then over in Asia as well. That's where a lot of our investment is going. A little bit about our first half results, which we put out a few weeks ago. Really important for us, are our members loving our service? We measure that through Net Promoter Score. Many of you will be familiar with that. Happily, many of our banking partners also use Net Promoter Score, so they're very familiar with it also. And we've got an NPS in the UK of in the mid-60s. To put that in some context, that's really bloody good. Anybody that's got a Net Promoter Score that higher than that, I would be suspicious of. I found a bank the other day that said they had a Net Promoter Score of 90, but that was surveying people to whom they had just given a mortgage successfully. That's cheating. So we measure it in the very traditional sense, and it's very high, and that's high around the world, albeit you get different scores in different cultures. As I say, we've recently won HSBC, OCBC, who own Bank of Singapore, a very respected bank in Southeast Asia. MI Card is a product in Japan. We also just won Rakuten in Japan too. And Visa International are rolling us out. We were already working with them in the States. Latin America we announced a while ago, but we've recently been rolling out with them in the Middle East and Eastern Europe as well. And our new platform is available in 10 languages and all three continents, multiple currencies as well, allowing our members to use us digitally, which helps us scale, but crucially helps members love the service, use the service, and learn more about what they can do for us as well. We listed in November last year. We raised just over £25 million. And we...
What do you mean by net revenue?
Net revenue. So net revenue is the revenue number, which is what we get paid in subscription, and then where we do make commissions, it's the commission we make. So some of our reported revenue has to include some travel revenue. So if we book a flight in a hotel, and let's say we make £10 commission on booking a flight in a hotel, net revenue includes the £10. But if buying that hotel and flight together was £3,000 of flights and hotels, that would go into our reported revenue. So our reported revenue makes us look bigger, but I think is less of a useful indicator for you. Since IPO, we've done well, much better than expected in terms of profitability and cash. We're in a stronger position than the analysts expected at IPO, quite significantly. And that's partly because our expansion into the Americas in particular was more efficient in Latin America than we expected it to be. We did a better job of getting up to speed quicker than we forecast ourselves. However, our net revenues didn't produce as much growth as we expected. And that was disappointing for us. And there were particular reasons for that, to do with contracts being pushed out. Particularly some of the growth with MasterCard and Visa has happened, but it's happened late. HSBC has happened at the end of our financial year. So really now, our end of financial year ends in August. We expected it to happen earlier. So we had a lot of revenue pushed to the right. And that made a difference because our revenue results were down versus what we expected at IPO. And so what that meant was our share price began at £1.34, went up to £1.65. And then because we missed, or I'm assuming because we missed that, that's certainly the feedback from the markets, because we then missed our revenue expectations, our share price is now at around a pound. So pipeline of new business stays very strong. The banks and other luxury brands want what we've got, particularly now that we've got the digital platform available in market as well. And then by area, if I choose Asia first, good net revenue growth into the first half. That actually doesn't include OCBC or HSBC because that's after these have been reported. So Asia was seeing very good growth in that area. And then EBITR is a break even. I'm actually potentially expecting that as we grow into some new markets across the region to go south a little bit before that comes back. For that reason that as we expand into new markets, that does eat up some EBITDA and some cash as well. The Americas, we've also got quite good growth. I'd like us to be growing much quicker in the US. To help us do that, actually, we've just hired the guy that was in charge of JP Morgan Chase affluent banking. And before that, he ran their premium credit card division. And he has joined us because he also sees a huge opportunity in the US as well. We've got some good clients there, but we want to be growing a lot quicker. So the Americas doing pretty well. We're very happy with our growth into Latin America and Canada, but the big one is the US itself. Something like 40% of the world's high net worth still in the US. And then in Europe, we haven't had growth in Europe in the last 6 months. However, we will be growing more with Coutts, we'll be growing more with HSBC Jade as well, and then other contracts that we're winning as we expand into new markets too. Why are we so confident that we win new contracts? That's that when new contracts come up, either net new or ones that are with competitors today, we've got about an 80% hit rate. So here are a bunch of examples of that over the last, this is really the contracts that we've pitched for in recent years. And we can normally announce a contract often only a few weeks before we actually launch it because the nature about the way the contracts are negotiated and so on. We are continuing to invest into tech. This is something which we've launched the latest version of our digital platform with HSBC recently. It's in market with Visa in some markets. In the UK, it's not those of you that bank with Coutts. They've not yet got the new version. That will happen in the coming few months. But it does. It allows people to book travel, book restaurants that aren't available to the public, book tickets that aren't available to the public, etc. So in summary, where are we today? Well, record satisfaction levels. We're continuing to invest in tech. We're continuing to expand into new geographies, but we've already gone over the hump in many new geographies, including the States, Latin America. We're just going over the investment hump in Hong Kong. So we're growing there very rapidly right now with HSBC. It's their biggest market for Jade, bigger than the UK even. Good, strong net cash position. Our net revenue, 6% up. That for us is very, very disappointing. Our CAGR over the last few years is kind of mid-20s, mid-20s, late-20s. So to have net revenue up 6%, that's not typical for us. And so that's something which we are expecting to reverse, and that's what the analysts' expectations are as well. We've got a very strong growing pipeline, and then we've got some new verticals as well. I'm just going to briefly touch on these. Because our tech is so far ahead of anything else out there, and because we've already got the global infrastructure and the very high service levels, we're using that to go after new markets. One market where the marketing's going out to our first 50 target clients in this week is the employee market, where employers who pay their average member of staff very well, we're encouraging them to buy our service for those top staff. So if you think Goldman Sachs, just to choose some really obvious examples, Goldman Sachs would be a target for us. Clifford Chance would be a target for us. McKinsey would be a target for us. Because their average staff member is very well paid. They want them to be very productive. By delegating things to us, that's making them more productive, less stressed, less hassled, less likely to be trying to buy tickets on a 9 o'clock on a Friday morning rather than actually doing their job. So it's a productivity sell, and it's an employee benefit sell as well. The employee loves it, the business loves it. But we're not going after mass market employers. Certainly not to begin with. We're also going after the auto market, and we're also going after the luxury market. As I say, we already do some work with Patek Philippe. We already do some work with a few other luxury brands, but it's quite small, and we think there's a lot more opportunity there. We've not gone after it aggressively till now. So that is a bunch of things about our business. I've got lots of slides. There's a handout that's got appendices in it as well, which has got a lot more numbers.
First question. Hi there, thank you. Great presentation. In terms of the bank segment, can you talk a little bit about what percent of a member base would actually be engaging with your benefit? And then the follow-up question to that is, yes, then how much in control are you in terms of marketing to those customers and new customers through your own channels versus the bank's channels?
That's a really good question. So I tend to keep it easy by breaking down into two groups. So kind of high net worth, the bank normally tends to make a lot more money from those people. Now, high net worth doesn't mean massively high net worth. Basically, anybody that's got investable assets of $1 million+, banks and wealth management businesses can afford to invest quite a lot because they'll be making 1% of assets under management as a minimum from you before they've even really sold you anything. So if they've got that investment with them. Those people are very keen to invest quite a lot with us. So there, what you tend to get as a member is a really good onboarding process, welcome brochure possibly in the post, ongoing contact where we'll say, tell us what bands or shows or whatever you never want to miss. We'll then get back in touch with you when they're about to go on sale. We will reach out to people in response to what they've told us about themselves, to be proactive with them. So on those, a good example there would be Coutts. HSBC Jade is close to that as well. And so there, the average member, if we've got a user group, an eligible user group of, let's say, 10,000, we would expect, as that matures, about half of those people to engage with us. And of the people engaged with us, they might engage on average 5-6 times a year. Some of them more often. Some of them would just use us for the special occasions and you know, for the family holiday or whatever else. In the mass market, most of our Visa contract is more like this. It's a little bit different because they don't make anything like as much money per person, and they can't afford to drive usage to those kind of levels. But where a classic book of high net worths might be 10,000 people or 40,000 people, or if it's globally with HSBC Jade, it'd be in the low hundreds of thousands, but right at the bottom end of that. I'd say that your second question was...
It was about the marketing control. Do you have that ability through your own channels to reach out and engage, or are you fully reliant on the bank?
So with many of our partners, we can do it, and we're responsible for it, and we do it. Again, Coutts is a good example, Investec is a good example. HSBC will be, I think, to begin with, they've got a high level of oversight of what we do and sign off on what we do as we get to know each other. But I expect that to end up in our remit. It gets harder with people where we don't yet have that level of trust. And there what happens is when we do outbound marketing, in the early days, we still need to go to them and say, this is the marketing we want to do. We go through a lengthy sign-off process. And that then means we can't do anything like as much marketing. But we've got a very strong record of once we've worked with people over a period of years, they unlock, they take the brakes off on that.
Thank you. I'd like to understand your cost base and your cost drivers. Sounds to me there's a high service element to your proposition here, which probably means face-to-face or person-to-person rather. Yep. Can you tell us about the ratio of staffing to clients and how that needs to flex?
Yes. So you're absolutely, it's not face-to-face as you self-corrected there. It's, but it is, there is a lot of our business today is high touch. So what that means is that when we start off in a market, a lifestyle manager might be doing 5 requests a day because they're building the supplier relationships, they're new, they're being managed by somebody new, they don't yet have things that make us a lot more efficient, like an allocation of tickets for the big shows and an allocation of tables at top restaurants. We then expect to get that number from 5 to 10 or 11 or even more than that. So that makes a big difference to our high touch service. And what allows that is maturity, content and tech that our lifestyle managers use. However, where we launch digital, more and more, we can allow our members to self-serve when they want to. And that increasingly for transactional things like, I want 4 Coldplay tickets. Actually, most of us today would be kind of rather do that digitally than call up, which is different to how it was 5 years ago. Similarly for straightforward travel. Complex travel, they're going to want to speak to a lifestyle manager. Simple travel, they'll book themselves. So as we invest more and more and more into our tech, we're seeing a higher percentage go through the platform. We charge our corporate clients less for that, but it's typically higher margin for us. So that's one of the dynamics in the business.
Sorry, a couple of boring accounting questions.
Yes.
In terms of the subscription income that you get, is it per person or is it in sort of block licenses, and how do you recognize that? And the second question relates to EBITDA, and thank you for using that rather than EBITDA. However, when you're dealing with amortization and that A in that metric, how do you deal with internally developed and capitalized costs and the amortization of that?
Yes. So we, so a big chunk of our cost, it's not as big as our people cost today, but a big chunk of our cost is building our technology. And some of that we consider maintenance and we just expense that, about half of it. The other half, we are building an asset with that and we amortize that over over 3 years or 5 years, depending. When it comes back to our members and how we get paid by the corporate, we effectively have a look at the level and type of usage that we're expecting from the corporate and we fix a price for that. We normally agree a contract guaranteed minimum. And then if usage and the type of usage goes above what's expected, the corporates pay us more. So it's not really per member, although clearly we then report and they understand it as a, you know, what is the cost per eligible member or per user. But it's really based on usage. And then as we drive more efficiencies into our business, and as we have done that, for instance, in Europe, that then becomes a 25% EBITDA margin business. We don't have those efficiencies yet in every market in Latin America or the Americas or Asia. So we're not yet at a positive, a flat margin in Asia and a negative margin in Americas.
I just want to understand how you guarantee tables at restaurants.
Yeah.
So hypothetically, if I own a small fashionable restaurant in London and it maybe has 40 covers and it's Valentine's or it's a particular busy Saturday, and I'm fully booked.
Yes.
People waiting outside the door. And one of your big shots comes along and says, I want a table at that restaurant.
Yes.
If I'm fully booked, how do you guarantee a table for me and my wife?
It's a great question because what we found in the world of lifestyle concierge, we deal with many different industries, dining's one, various different travel industries as well. They've all got their guilty dark secrets. And we've had to spend years finding out what they are. So for a start, we can't absolutely guarantee, apart from where we've got a held table. For many restaurants, many restaurants in London and Hong Kong and now in other markets as well, we have held tables which are held for 10, and then we just say, this table we're releasing to Stephen plus one, this table we're releasing, this table of four we're releasing to this particular member. So those are our tables held in our name, and you've got to have a great reputation in the restaurant industry to hold those tables. But those were the tables, for instance, that gave us the tables and give us tables every week at Chiltern Firehouse, Sexy Fish, Zuma, Koya, Heston, Dinner at Heston, etc. The Fat Duck give us all their cancellations, for instance.
Does that mean that if I've got 40 covers and you walked into my restaurant on that Saturday night, there'd be five or six tables that are just blank?
No.
Held for your...
We would hold those tables normally until lunchtime of the evening, if it's an evening table. Then we hand them back to the restaurant. And that works. That works extremely well for us and for the restaurant because normally we fill them, and when we don't, they've still got other ways of filling them. But you're right; they hate empty tables. The other thing that we do is that when you call up as a member of the public, you deal with the firstly you look online. Then the next port of call is the restaurant themselves, and you phone up the reservation line. There are three types of table. There's the open tables, which is just the ones that they don't even think they're going to fill. They'll stick on open table. Then the reservationist can give you, of those 40 covers, the reservationist can maybe get sign off on about 30, 34 of them. Then the head reservationist holds back three or four tables. And then the restaurant manager has got rights over one or two tables. That would be typical. We've got direct contacts with the restaurant manager when we need them. But typically the head reservationist can help us. This on top of held tables. So we're very careful not to guarantee availability because sometimes a table just is full. Tables at top restaurant in Cannes during various weeks there are just full. So we need to be very careful about things like that. But if we can't get availability, pretty much nobody can. And we have very, very high levels of success. Does that answer that?
A quick question about the competitive landscape. It seems to me to be logical that the real power in this industry lies with the credit card issuers because they have the perfect database of high net worths, how much they're spending, where they're spending it. And offering a concierge-style service seems to be quite a compelling offering for the credit card issuers.
Yes.
Where do we sit in the context? Are they our biggest competitors here? And I did notice also that you've signed up a few credit card issuers on an earlier slide, but are they effectively then not differentiating themselves from the others who've also signed up for your service?
Yes. Yeah, it's a very good question as well. So I would say that the credit card is, in the financial services market, which is our biggest market to date, credit cards is half the story. Wealth management and private banking and the top end of retail banking is the other half. Actually, we get bigger budgets per head from wealth management, retail banking and private banking because all of you are worth more on average to your private bank than you are to your credit card issuer because they just make more money from you that way. So they then got bigger budgets for us. Having said that, differentiation is really interesting. We work with Visa and American Express. And actually, we work with Diners Card as well in Japan. And so we then have to differentiate. So with Coutts, for instance, they sponsor various things. We include those assets as unique benefits with Coutts. With Visa, we might develop a different product. And sometimes HSBC have paid us to develop unique assets for them which are particularly aligned with their brand, which sit on our platform, which are highly visible. So that's how we differentiate. Then, increasingly around the world, with us winning 80% of the B2B contracts that come up, we want to become, and believe we will become, the strongest player in the market. And with that scale, we then have better service outcome. So then we win even more contracts and grow the size of those contracts. So that's our game plan.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I've spotted one potential bump in the road, certainly for people in the travel space, is that when they're booking on behalf of a client, they're often using their card, the customer's card, to actually make the booking.
Yes.
That's going to become extremely difficult, if not impossible, under the Payment Services Directive and strong customer authentication that they're introducing. Have you spotted that problem? And
we definitely have. So we love that because it does make it more difficult for other people, but not for us. So we are PCI compliant to the nth degree. There are many different levels of PCI compliance. We're at the kind of fifth gate of hell there. So we've got the worst possible time, as in it's a real bugbear for us, but it's a massive competitive advantage. And then our platform allows us to tokenize the credit card details and then use those without us actually having access after they've been given to us. But you're absolutely right that there's lots of people in the travel industry. I've got a nasty shot coming down the road.
I was just going to ask roughly how many underlying clients do you have? And what is the approximate range of a typical subscription cost?
So it does range a lot. It comes back to the question earlier on. So some programs we are paid, literally pounds per eligible user because the usage rates haven't yet got to a level where there's high use. In some of our high net worth programs, we'll be paid several hundred pounds per member per year to deliver the service. So it's a bit a penny to £1,000 kind of territory. And that's one reason why we don't yet report revenue per user, although that is something we're thinking about moving to, because it is something we measure internally.
And if you were to offer an individual the opportunity to subscribe, yes, you'd price it at £1,000.
Individuals can join and do join, but that's a small part of our business and it's not something we're investing in heavily. Individual members, if they want a single point of contact who becomes a kind of family friend, that's £300 a month, because those people use us a lot. They're using us on average 10 or 11 times a month. Or if they use a program very similar to our corporate program, then it's £100 a month. So that's why it's often easier to get it. My family, who are all members, get it through one of the banks. It's the most cost-effective way of doing it. Some people, they want to have a direct relationship with us.
Yeah. Sorry, back to the sort of data with the banks around the way that they use this, either for acquisition or retention. Can you talk about some of the sort of results that they see using you versus, I guess the benchmark of what they have today?
Yeah, so it's a great chart. So what banks can see is they see an increase in assets under management from people that are engaged with Concierge versus people that aren't. They see an increase in retention.
Any numbers you can give, or just vague increase?
We're not allowed to give them because they're bound up
blended.
I'm going to have to get back to you on that, or rather, I'm going to have to get back to everybody on that. I'd love to. I would. We are able to share some data from some of our banks who are restricted to one nation, to banks that don't compete with them. But that's the only way we're allowed to use that data today. But we'd love to get some case studies published. And the moment we can, we'll publish them to our shareholder group and investors as well as to the trade.
So is your primary metric that you're driving for the bank is around retention, stickiness, they don't leave?
And share of customer.
And then share of customer.
That's right.
Okay, thank you very much, Alex.
Well, thank you. Thanks, everybody.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.